an idea whose time has come. It's 100 years after the Civil War. What took so long for this idea's time to come?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question because arguably it was an idea whose time was 100 years too late. But, of course, what happened in the aftermath of the Civil War was that the South couldn't really reconcile itself to the Union victory. And so starting in the late 19th century and continuing all through the 20th century, they imposed a series of Jim Crow segregation laws throughout the region that kept blacks and whites separate from every sphere of public life. And as the 20th century wore on and so many rapid technological changes and social changes had happened, and a whole generation of young black servicemen came back from World War II, and they'd had experience abroad where they did not have to face this kind of discrimination. And really the modern civil rights movement was born in Montgomery, Alabama, with the bus boycott of Martin Luther King in 1955, and continuing right up until 1963 when the bill was proposed by President Kennedy, really in the wake of those horrifying demonstrations in Birmingham when the dogs and fire hoses, you know, knocked demonstrators to the ground and outraged the country and really the world. So that's what forced the people in Washington to finally do something about the problem that had been there for, you know, decades.
You would have been a young boy at that time. Do you remember seeing some of those things on the television news?
No, I really don't remember. I would have been five at the December of 1964. And I'm ashamed because my family took a car vacation to Florida in the winter of 1964 and again in the winter of 1965. And I'm quite sure that the circumstances driving down through, you know, Tennessee and Georgia must have been very different by 1965 than just the year before, and I have no memory of it at all, of course, no memory of the pictures on TV. I do remember later, you know, I was older, I remember Martin Luther King and his assassination, that I remember quite clearly, but I don't really remember the demonstrations, and I don't remember the debates about the law or anything like that.
So what piqued your interest in this particular issue?
Well, my editor at Vanity Fair, a wonderful man named Cullen Murphy, who had come to the magazine from the Atlantic Monthly, where he was the managing editor. About 3.5 years ago, he realized this anniversary was coming up, and he urged me to take a look at the story because it's usually a chapter or a section in somebody else's book. It hasn't really been a book of its own. And the little preliminary research I did persuaded me that I didn't really know the half of the whole story. We think of this bill as being the result of Dr. King's demonstrations and the grief and guilt of Kennedy's assassination and then Lyndon Johnson's incredible legislative, you know, skill. But it was so much more complicated, and I didn't realize what a huge grassroots effort there had been across the country, not just as we think of, you know, the March on Washington and Dr. King, but a huge interfaith coalition of religious groups who targeted their efforts really strategically on the Midwest and the Plain States, where congressmen and senators did not have large black constituencies but had lots of Methodists and Presbyterians and Baptists and Catholics and would be susceptible to an appeal from the pulpit. And with almost pinpoint precision, they focused on those particular members and had a devastating effect. I knew, having grown up in Illinois and my mother's father was a friend of Senator Dirksen, I knew that the bill was a bipartisan effort and I knew that Republicans were obviously crucial to its passage because of the divisions among the Democrats, the Southern Democrats being so opposed to any change in the status quo. But I didn't realize what an overwhelmingly bipartisan effort it was, and that in the Senate, for example, the bill passed 73-27 with 27 out of 33 Republican votes. So in proportional terms, the Republicans were actually far more important. And, you know, nothing could pass the Senate 73-27 today, not an agreement on the shape of the table. I mean, it's kind of breathtaking. And so the more the research I did, the more I thought this story would be timely and welcome because it stands in such a complete contrast to what's going on in Washington today. And while in the book I don't beat the reader over the head with those comparisons, I think they probably jump out at most people and are pretty striking.
Was that sort of bipartisan cooperation unusual for that time, or was that more the norm up until recent times?
It was more the norm in some ways. It was especially the norm on civil rights because there were really, in functional terms, three parties. And so the big Democratic majorities that President Kennedy and President Johnson had in the Congress were really an illusion because the Southerners were totally opposed to civil rights. So in the Senate, for example, there weren't even really 50 senators, 50 Democrats, solidly behind this bill. So that meant, and in those days, to cut off debate and end a filibuster, you needed 67 votes, not 60 like now. So that meant that there had to be bipartisan cooperation. And because of the Republicans still taking themselves very seriously as the party of Lincoln, there was willingness to cooperate on those questions. And the other thing that happened was, in those days, people in Washington certainly knew each other much more. They spent more time there. Their families, by and large, lived there. And their kids went to school together and played sports together. And I think we have to be careful not to over-romanticize the past, because there were a lot of problems, certainly, too. But I think it was very hard for people to treat their colleagues with contempt if they'd had dinner in their house the night before. And during the debate, you see all sorts of examples on the floor of the Senate and of the House of bitter disagreements over the substance of the policy, and then gestures of friendship and collegiality at the end of the day, where they repair to, you know, share a blow for liberty, as President Truman used to say. And I think, I don't mean to sound facetious about it, but one thing that I think must have also helped the debate move along was they drank huge amounts, and they drank all day long during business hours. And Senator Dirksen had a room in the back of his office called the Twilight Lodge, and it had a fully stocked bar and a clock on the wall with every hour marked 5. So it was always a perfectly appropriate time for a drink. And one of Senator Humphrey's former aides told me that as a young man, 29 years old, working on the final negotiations of the bill, he'd been in Senator Dirksen's office late one morning and started to help himself to a glass of what he thought was ice water from a crystal pitcher on the table. And the secretary said, "Don't touch that." And he said, "What, the senator's picky about his water?" And the answer came, "No, no, it's not water." And in fact, it was gin, and Dirksen came in and poured himself a big tumbler full and drank it down at 11:30 in the morning and then went back on the floor of the Senate. And I think, you know, that's sort of unimaginable now. And again, you don't want to advocate for public drunkenness, and there were senators in that era who were so drunk they had to be propped up in their seats. But I think the air of collegiality and the air of mutual respect is something we could definitely do with a little more of now.
So there's no Twilight Lounge anymore.
No, I don't think there's any. Senators do still have their hideaways. And even 20 years ago, when I was covering the debate over Hillary Clinton's health care bill, you could tell that some senators, if the session went on into the evening, had gone to their hideaways to have a pop or two. But I don't think it was anything like the 50 years ago.
A few minutes ago, you mentioned the role religious groups played in this. Are we talking white religious denominations as well as black?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we obviously think of, you know, the black churches and being very influential, and of course, the church movement in the South. Dr. King's movement was called the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. But because so many of these crucial swing votes in the Senate, particularly from the Midwest or from the Great Plains, didn't have black constituents, they had no narrow self-interest in being for civil rights. So in some ways, it was the white church groups that were particularly effective with these members, because they could speak to them sort of, you know, pastor to flock. And they were quite calculated about how they would do it. They would have the local bishop, who might have been a classmate of the senator, call him and put a special touch on him. Senator Carl Mundt of South Dakota, a very conservative Republican who was very reluctant to vote for the bill and certainly reluctant to cut off debate, was heard to exclaim in the Senate cloakroom one day when he'd taken a vote sympathetic to the civil rights forces, "I hope that satisfies those two goddamn bishops who called me last night." And they were quite strategic about the lobbying, too. I mean, Mike Mansfield, who was the majority leader in the Senate, and Hubert Humphrey, who was the field general, the floor manager for the bill, they knew that Carl Mundt's wife, Mary, was a supporter of the bill. So every morning after they knew that Senator Mundt had gone to the office, somebody on the staff would call Mrs. Mundt and give her the talking points for the day that she was supposed to tell her husband when he came home that night to lobby him. And I think that's an example of how people did know each other in a quite intimate way, and they knew where people might be vulnerable and whom they might listen to, and it made a difference.
As you grew up in Macomb, were you aware of the impact of this legislation?
Well, you know, I have to say I grew up in Macomb, and I don't know what the situation is like today, but when I grew up in Macomb, there were really maybe 10 or 15 black families in Macomb. And I confess that I didn't really have any black classmates in my elementary school. I had a few black classmates at Edison and at Macomb High. But like President Kennedy and to a certain degree like most of the members of Congress, we got to remember at this time there were 5 black members out of 535 in the House and Senate who were black. Everyone else was white. The black people I knew growing up were, you know, the janitor in my father's office, a wonderful man named Joe Coleman, and his wife Nadine, who sometimes helped out at holidays with doing kitchen work for my mother or for my grandmother. And I did not know black professionals. John Kennedy, when he was running for president in 1960, was asked by a black dentist in San Francisco how many black professionals he knew, and he said he didn't know more than five that he could call by their first name. And the irony is that the black people John Kennedy knew were his two valets and Martin Luther King and the leaders of the movement itself. But he was his education took a while, but he ultimately came very firmly to the side that this was a moral issue that had to be confronted by the country. And when he proposed the bill in June of 1963, he said just that. He said this is primarily a moral issue, as old as the scriptures and as clear as the American Constitution. And no president had ever really said anything like that. And I think sometimes President Kennedy's boldness and courage in doing that gets a little bit lost in memory, because he made so many other speeches, the Ich bin ein Berliner, Ask Not What Your Country Can Do For You. But I think in some ways the speech he made on June 11th, 1963 was really the bravest speech of his life.
Do you think he could have gotten this done in 1964, an election year?
Well, you know, it's a question that so many people have asked me, and it's one that historians debate. I think Robert Caro is on the record, the great Johnson biographer, saying that he does not think if Kennedy had lived that we'd have this bill today. I think Kennedy had become so invested in it by that point, and while he was very cautious, he also liked to win. And he'd put so much of his own prestige on the line and had invested so much political capital in it that I don't think he could have walked away from it. The bill might have been watered down in ways that Johnson was unwilling to do, and it might have taken longer to pass, but I have to think that it would have passed eventually simply because it would have been so humiliating for Kennedy to have it fail.
Even the version passed under Johnson is watered down. What was left out of it?
Well, you know, it got watered down in some sense in that it did not do the things that the most ardent advocates of civil rights wanted it to do. So, for example, the voting rights provision was comparatively weak. It didn't apply to state and local elections. It didn't outlaw literacy tests. That was left for the next year to the Voting Rights Act, where they came back and finished the job. But unlike most civil rights bills before this, it really did get stronger at every step of the way. And by the end of the passage, there was a much stronger provision on employment discrimination than had been in the initial Kennedy bill. The initial Kennedy bill would only apply to federal contractors, and it didn't really have many teeth in it. And by the time the bill was passed, it was a very strong provision, and it allowed for litigation in the courts. And because of the mischief of one of the civil rights opponents in the House, Howard Smith of Virginia, the chairman of the Rules Committee, he was hoping to insert a poison pill that might kill the bill. So on the Saturday morning when it was being debated near final passage in the House, he inserted the word sex as a protected category of employment discrimination. And all the male chauvinists who were running the place went crazy because they thought this might doom the bill. But the handful of women members of the House rose up and said, this is the least you can give us, and it will make the bill stronger. And in fact, when the bill was passed and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission got up and running a year later, the first flood of complaints were not racial discrimination but gender discrimination, and it revolutionized the workplace and revolutionized the field of women's law and women's rights and really gave a tremendous boost to the women's movement, all because of this horrible old racist who was hoping to scuttle the bill.
Do you feel the bill is still effective today?
Well, you know, the bill ended legal segregation, and one of the compromises that was brought about was really urged by Senator Dirksen, because he knew that Illinois already had strong anti-discrimination laws on the books. And in that classic, good Midwestern conservative way, he did not want the federal government to force duplication of effort. He didn't want, as he saw it, a small businessman in Peoria or Pekin to be harassed by two sets of record-keeping. So the compromise he worked out was that in places where there were already discrimination, anti-discrimination laws on the books, the states would have first crack and the feds would come only afterwards. And that had the effect of really limiting the bill, focusing the bill on the South. And the South, the Southern senators, knew precisely what that was for. It was to try to bring along fellow Midwesterners to support cutting off the bill and passing the bill. But it left unaddressed completely questions of economic disparity, and it also left unaddressed de facto segregation that persists to this day in Chicago or Boston or Washington or Philadelphia. And so that part of the challenge, I think, remains very much unsolved. And on the night he proposed the bill, President Kennedy offered up a whole series of sobering statistics about the differential prospects of a black and white baby born the same day in the same place in 1963. And on questions like health and life expectancy and access to college, the conditions are incredibly much better today. But on questions like median income and lifetime earning power and things like that, it's almost exactly the same as it was 50 years ago, with blacks way, way behind. So I think, we should be careful not to be too celebratory about this, because the job is not done. Just as it wasn't done 50 years ago, it's not done today.
Does it need to be done or completed through legislation?
Well, I think, one of the things that happened in the aftermath of the Civil Rights Bill, and actually partly what caused the splintering of the consensus that had produced this bill, was as the 60s went on and the 70s went on, questions arose and, programs like affirmative action and busing and race-conscious remedies as opposed to color-blind remedies, which is what really the Civil Rights Bill was supposed to be. I think the country remains very divided in their intense debates about whether you can really create equality of condition or only equality of opportunity. And there's a lot of, ink been spilled and a lot of studies been done about why black income still lags white income so badly, why, black family structure is so problematic. So I think it's work that cannot be done by legislation alone, and I think it is probably an ongoing challenge. And when President Obama talks about economic inequality being, in a sense, the challenge of our time, I think it's not wrong to see that as a basic civil rights issue as well, about why the disparity between rich and poor has continued to grow so dramatically in this country and endures so stubbornly.
So a lot of this needs to perhaps be done at the grassroots level?
Well, I think one of the lessons of this bill is that it passed because there was such enormous grassroots support for it to pass, and so many people kind of on the barricades and in their own communities doing work. I think it's certainly safe to say that it's very hard to change Washington from inside Washington, and certainly President Obama has learned that in these last 5 years. And the lesson of this bill is that people in Washington were moved to change because the country was changing, and the members of Congress had to struggle to keep up with the country. And I think, I sometimes wonder what would happen today on an issue like immigration if the Conference of Catholic Bishops and the part of the evangelical movement that's concerned with economic justice and social justice got together somehow in a coalition. I wonder if they would have more effect on that debate, which has been so stubbornly resistant to solution. I don't know the answer, but I do think that, we the people are the ones in the end of the day who have to do the work and have to take the issue to the representatives. I don't think we can depend on. And the other thing that was interesting to me in doing this research is 50 years ago, the country was terribly divided, arguably much more divided than it is today. I mean, it was really, as we know, there was, demonstrations and violence in the streets, and it really seemed like we were on the verge of a second civil war in a way. But Washington was much more unified, and people were willing to work together across party lines. And now we face a situation which the country is divided, but it's not nearly so bitterly divided, not nearly so intensely divided as the Congress is. The Congress is way disproportionately polarized compared to the whole country, and that's partly because of the districting situation over the past 50 years. Districts have gotten redder and redder and bluer with no incentive to compromise, and no one's afraid of losing to the opposite party in the fall. They're afraid of getting a primary from their right or left flank, and that's had the effect of making members of Congress really much more extreme than their constituents, than the country as a whole would suggest they should be.
All right, thanks.
Thanks you very much. Sorry, I don't have anything. So now we get a twofer here.
Yes.